Okay, so I want to pick up from where we left off last week in the Haggadah. Last week we started discussing part of the Haggadah that actually tells the story of the Exodus. Last week we discussed the verses that are quoted to point out the situation of the Jews in Egypt, not in terms of slavery, but in terms of how they were reproducing at amazing growth rates, how they remained distinguished as Jews, they didn't assimilate, they maintained their identity. So that was last week's discussion. So Haggadah continues discussing the actual slavery itself. And before we read what the Haggadah says, it's important to understand the idea of slavery, meaning that the story of the Exodus is that God freed us from slavery. The miracles of the Makos, the 10 plagues, the miracles of splitting of the sea, of God exacting justice on the wicked, rewarding the righteous, that's part of the story. But in order to understand the greatness of those miracles, we have to understand the tragedy of the slavery itself. Our gratitude becomes so much more powerful. We understand how terrible the slavery was. So only if we discuss the slavery do we understand the freedom. Only if we discuss the tragedy do we understand the triumph and the salvation which was there. And our gratitude towards God becomes much stronger and much more emotional if we understand how terrible it was in Egypt. The next part of the Haggadah is going to discuss the actual suffering that we had in Egypt. So let's start reading. The very top of the page, the verse quoted, again, this is a verse quote being quoted from Parshas Kisavo. We discussed last week, it's all from the reading, the declaration that was said when the Jews brought their first fruits to the temple. This is all part of that quote, that summary. This is a summary of the story. So it says, the Egyptians treated us badly, and they made us suffer, and they put hard work upon us. Again, these translations are from the Chabad website. I don't vouch for translations, but it seems pretty accurate to me. It says three things. They treated us badly, they made us suffer, and they put hard work upon us. So there's a Haggadah written, it's called Yad Mitzrayim, it's in a commentary on the Haggadah. And he points out a very interesting point. There's a famous question, kind of a philosophical question, but it's a question which may have popped into our minds before. It's an important question to think about. That question is, if you look in the Chumash, so God already promised to Abraham that there'll be slavery for 400 years. In the covenant God made between himself and Abraham in the very beginning of Jewish history,
There will be slavery.
It's the covenant, it's called Bris Bein HaBesharim. It's the covenant between the parts, which is really the initial agreement, a promise made from Hashem to Abraham, the first Jew. It says it to Abraham, I don't think to Moses. I mean, but Moses is already there at the end of the slavery. But the covenant to Abraham, long before the slavery.
Moses says to the people that you're going to, that he might tell them directly.
They already had experienced it for two centuries at that point. But the deal made between Hashem and Abraham, is going to read it to you as so this is the deal made. This is the very first bris, the very first covenant between Hashem and Abraham. It says, "Vayomer l'Avram." Hashem said to Avram, "You should know that your children are going to be strangers in a land which is not theirs. They will be enslaved. They will be tormented for 400 years. But the nation which enslaves them, I will judge, and they will leave with great wealth." That's what God promised. That's what God foretells to Abraham. That's the prophecy Abraham receives as part of the covenant made between Abraham and God. So this is preordained, the slavery. The slavery is preordained. Why does God punish the Egyptians?
Why does he punish the descendants of Abraham?
Well, that's a different question. Because that's a little bit last week, that question. But the question for today would be, why does God punish the Egyptians? They're doing God's command. God said that you're going to be enslaved for 400 years, and the Egyptians were just following what God said to do. They're doing a mitzvah. They're following God's word. So why is it that the Egyptians get punished? This is a question which is asked by many of the earliest sources, the Rambam and the Ramban, and many other early commentators, later commentators discuss this question. So the Rambam, Maimonides, he answers that even though God told Abraham, your children will be enslaved, God never forced any particular nation to enslave the Jews. People still have free choice. The Egyptians chose to step into that role and be the cruel oppressors, so they get punished for making that choice. mean, we don't always understand how God's ways work. We don't understand how free choice balances out with God's prophecies. But bottom line is that the Egyptians had free choice. They did not have to be the ones. God never told Abraham which nation they would be subject to. God didn't say which nation will make you into slaves.
You just did, excuse me, when you read, didn't you say the Egyptians?
No, it didn't say the Egyptians. It just says, in a land which is not yours. That's all it says. In a land which is not theirs. It doesn't say the Egyptians. The Egyptians, based on their own free will, opted to become that nation. That's why they deserve punishment. That's the answer that Maimonides gives. But
the Egyptians didn't know. They just were
people. Yeah, right. So God has his ways. The Egyptians, right, in their cruelty, enslaved us.
You can have a slave and still treat them your family.
That's true as well. We'll get to that in a minute. That's a good point. Right.
Excuse my ignorance here.
Yes.
Ignorance of history. Where else were the Jews living? In Rome? Where else was there such a population of Jews that another nation could have made that decision?
At that time, nowhere. But let's say they moved to Egypt, and the Egyptians did not enslave them, so God would have had it happen in some other way.
I see.
They didn't have to be the Egyptians.
I see.
So they happened to have been in Egypt, but didn't have to be the Egyptians.
Thank you.
So, but the commentator, Yad Mitzrayim, points out that we see three other reasons why the Egyptians were punished based on this verse. This verse says they treated us badly, they made us suffer, they put hard work upon us. So let's read how God explained each part of this verse, and then we'll explain how this answers our question. So first it says, the Egyptians treated us badly, as it is said, come let us act cunningly with the people, lest they multiply, and if there should be a war against us, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the land. So if the Egyptians were enslaving the Jews, because that's God's will. God told Abraham the Jews have to be slaves, we're going to do God's will, God's mitzvah, we're going to enslave the Jews. But it says here in the Torah that was not their intent. Their intent was that they were threatened themselves. They felt threatened by the Jews. Jews would rebel against them and take over the land. And that's why they enslaved the Jews. They wanted to break our bodies and our spirits so we could not rebel. So if they had a pure intent that we're trying to fulfill God's word, okay, maybe it would have been a different story. But their intent was certainly not pure. Their intent was, and the Hebrew word vayareyu, is they did evil to us. So it's translated as treated us badly. But literally, vayareyu means they did ra. Ra means evil. They did evil to us. I mean, their intent was an evil intent. It was not a pure intent. Had their intent been to fulfill God's will, maybe a different story. But their intent was an evil intent, and that deserves punishment. That's point number one. The next point made in the Haggadah, they made us suffer. As it is said, they set taskmasters over the people of Israel to make them suffer with their burdens, and they built storage cities for Pharaoh, Pitom, and Ramses. So the second point, which you pointed out before, is that they didn't just enslave us and make us, you could treat a slave in a humane manner. You could say, okay, you're my worker, I respect you, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to feed you, you have to work for me. But let's be productive together, I'll give you a nice place to live, I'll make sure you're comfortable, and you'll be my servant. It says here very explicitly that they made us suffer, and that was with intent. They put taskmasters to make us suffer with their burdens. It goes beyond the suffering. So number one, they're very cruel, and the work given to us was work which caused us to suffer. But also, the Hebrew term used here is l'man ano so v'siv lo sam. They wanted to just oppress us through the labor, meaning that usually a slave, you actually have some sort of benefit from. You want them to make you more productive. Just to distinguish, you know, these slave owners in the South, 200 years ago in America, so they weren't necessarily cruel people, but they had plantations and they were workers. That's how it worked. And I'm not defending it, you know, but I'm just saying when there was intent there was for their own economical benefit. And they're trying to become wealthier people. They didn't just torment people for no reason, at least the typical slave owner, to my knowledge. And it wasn't useless persecution. The Egyptians were persecuting the Jews just for the sake of breaking us down, breaking our spirits, making us suffer. And we'll discuss this more in a minute. But it wasn't necessarily for their own financial gain. So for instance, the rabbis tell us that they would build cities purposely on bad foundations that would collapse. So they'd have the Jews build these buildings. They'd come back a day later and they would be collapsed to the ground because the foundation wasn't stable. And the Egyptians knew that it wasn't a stable foundation, but they wanted to just make us suffer. So therefore, they gave us work with no gain involved.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The thing that we just read here does quote a reason for work, which to build the storage cities for Pharaoh, Pithom, and Ramses. It seems that there was a purpose according to this sentence here. It wasn't people, just for nothing.
There's 2 points made. Number one is the first half, to make them suffer with their... I mean, you have to see the Hebrew. Leman ano sil besiv lo sam, to make them suffer. Part of the purpose was making them suffer. That is the purpose.
It's too different.
And number two, the storage states were... I'll talk about those soon, but those cities, based on the wording used in the Torah, the rabbis tell us interesting things about those cities, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the... But we'll see. I want to discuss the slavery more, because I think we have to understand how tragic the slavery really was. It wasn't just working hard. There's a lot more to it. But ultimately, the work done was not primarily for the Egyptians' economic benefit. It was actually just to make us suffer and to break us down. So that's number two. So another reason they deserve punishment was the cruelty involved. They weren't using us as faithful employees. They were actually being cruel for the sake of being cruel. That's number two. That's to make us suffer. And then it says they put hard work upon us. As it is said, the Egyptians made the children of Israel work with rigor. They made their lives bitter with hard work, with mortar, and with bricks, and all manner of service in the field. All their work, which they made them work with rigor. We'll pause there for a second. So the hard work also, even if they were enslaving us, but giving us normal jobs, that'd be one thing. But the work was back-breaking labor. It was not only was it for no benefit, but it was also very, very difficult work, back-breaking work, work which was unbearable. And part of this, as I mentioned before, a lot of the work was for naught. They didn't get to see their accomplishments. Now the tragedy of slavery, besides the fact that you're not your own person, besides the fact that you're subject to somebody else, part of the tragedy of slavery is that all of us, we take pride in our work. You know, I work, I accomplish something, I make money for myself, I can show what I've accomplished, what I've produced. And even a slave can get that feeling, a slave, so their accomplishments go to their master. But if the slave can say, look, I built that building, so they still feel some sort of emotional fulfillment in that. But if you put forth your effort day in and day out for projects which are worthless, and the building collapses after you put in days and days of labor, so then you don't have anything to show for yourself. Not only does anything you produce goes to your master, the work is hard, and there's nothing to take pride in. I have no accomplishments to take pride in for myself. So the deepest tragedy of the slavery isn't just the hard work they did, but they felt no sense of self or accomplishment. That's part of this tragedy. So the fact that the Egyptians gave them such terrible labor which was not for any benefit, and they enslaved them with evil intent. So for those three reasons, that's why they deserve punishment. So even though it's preordained by God, the Jews to be enslaved, it wasn't in this manner. It didn't have to be this way. It didn't have to be with such cruelty, useless work, just backbreaking work. So all of that deserves punishment on behalf of the Egyptians. So for instance, it says that they built a city called Pitom, as it says here. So the rabbis say Pitom is very similar to the word Pitahom, at the mouth of the abyss. And this alludes to the fact that they were built on unstable foundations, as we said before. That the ground would be shaky ground, it'd be muddy, and the buildings would sink into the ground or collapse into the foundations they were in, because it was at the mouth of an abyss, these buildings. That's where they would build the foundation of the buildings that they had to build. The term used for storage cities in Hebrew is the word miskenos. Miskenos is the same root as sakana. Sakana means danger. Dangerous. Because these buildings endangered their lives. They build a building, but if the buildings were not built on stable ground, the buildings would collapse upon them. And that's so even though it's translated here as storage cities, but there is a reference in the Hebrew text to dangerous buildings, buildings which would be dangerous for the builders. That's the idea of miskenos. Right? Pita home is the mouth of the abyss. So if they fall down into the depths of the ground and sink into quicksand, it would fall into, there'd be sinkholes. The rabbis tell us that they would make sure the people got the jobs they were not used to. If you're trying to be productive, trying to be efficient, so you would take the person who's a carpenter and let them do carpentry. Take the farmer and let him farm. You would take the person who is a tailor and let them sew your clothing. But they would switch people around to jobs which they're not used to because they wanted to make them suffer. People could, you know, it's very difficult. If you're not a carpenter, they say, okay, go build me a table. So you're going to feel very distraught. They're going to whip you if you don't do it. That's what they would do. They'd have men do jobs women do jobs men would do, and they would switch people to jobs which are not for them, just, again, to break them, to torment them, to persecute them. And it wasn't for their own financial gain. It was just in order to break the Jews down.
So the women were subject to the same rigors and labor that the men were?
Absolutely. And I'll discuss that more soon, but yes. The women and the children as well. The One other point on this quote, and then I want to read to you some of the descriptions of the work. The first term used again, the Egyptians treated us badly. So the Hebrew is vayareu. Vayareu can be translated in many ways. So one is that they did evil to us. Treating us badly is one translation. It could also be translated as they vilified us. They gave us a bad reputation. Some commentaries explain that when Pharaoh got scared, and Pharaoh thought that we were threatening his empire, so he had to paint us as evil people. Because nobody wants to do anything negative to somebody who they think is a good person. I mean, that's human psychology. No one wants to be an evil person. Therefore, if I'm going to hurt someone else, I'm going to enslave someone else, I'm going to murder someone else, I have to somehow paint them as an evil person in my mind. Which we see all the time, you know, in current events. You see it all over. Politics, I mean, you see it everywhere.
Demonizing.
Yeah. Right. So demonize someone else. So Paro thought that these Jews, I mean, the Jews themselves, they weren't doing any harm. You know, Yosef, who was their uncle and their father, he was the one who supported the entire land of Egypt for many, many years. He was a wise and kind ruler. These were Yosef's children and nieces and nephews. And at this point, the Egyptians should have felt very grateful towards the Jews. We weren't doing anything wrong. We didn't mean to harm anyone. We were just farming in our own land, you know, doing our own thing. But yet, so Pharaoh had to demonize us. He thought that we would be ungrateful to the land, which took us in. We left the land of Canaan because of the famine, came down into Egypt. And the Jews would have been grateful people. Thank you for hosting us. You know, we're happy to be here and have food. You took care of Yosef, and you know, gave him power, and we thank you for that. But Pharaoh had to say, no, they're going to rebel. They're going to be ungrateful people, and that's why we have to stop them. We have to crush them. So many times evil begins with a fear, a misunderstanding, which leads to lashon hara, you know, baseless maligning of another person or another group. And from there, you can build on that. It mushrooms into something much bigger. So initially, because Pharaoh felt threatened, they thought they're not going to be grateful. They're going to rebel. They're going to come rise up against us. They don't feel gratitude for the fact that we're hosting them in our land. So at that point, he was able now to feel that we were a terrible people and then started enslaving us. But look throughout history, it's a pattern. But usually before any tragedy hits a nation, when it's brought on by another nation, usually it begins with demonizing, maligning, vilifying another person, another nation, and then from that they build up more and more, and that you have a bad reputation, you're now no longer a people, you're now considered animals, you're considered terrible people, you're subhuman, and now I can unleash the cruelty against you. I mean, it's very clear what Hitler did. Hitler did that 100%, and we see it throughout history everywhere else that way. So began it, so vayareu, they did evil to us, means they gave us an evil reputation, and at that point, even the everyday Egyptian was very happy to persecute a Jew. Because they were subhuman. Who are these Jews? Why should I care? Yeah.
So the Jews lived in Egypt fine for a while? How long were they okay before they were enslaved?
The slavery did not start until all the tribes died. So the 12 tribes came down to Egypt with Yaakov. Yaakov died. Once the 12 sons died, after that, gradually the slavery began.
But the Jews were like ruling.
So how many years
Joseph? How many years was that? Let's think for a second. Joseph was 30 years old when he was brought into power in Egypt.
He was 30 years old?
He was 30 years old. When he stood before Pharaoh and put into power, he was 30 years old. His father came down, I think it was 9 years later. And then Yosef died. I don't remember exactly. It was approximately, let's say, 80, 90 years after that. So probably for about between 80 to 100 years, around there, estimate, things were going smoothly. And Yosef was in power. The Jews had the power. The Jews were providing for him. Only after that did things start going downhill.
But his children, the children of Joseph and the tribes, they were still living for, I don't know, another 50 or 100 years.
Yeah, but they started suffering. Once their parents, once the actual 12 tribes died, the actual sons of Jacob died, at that point the suffering began.
And that was after Joseph died, right?
Yeah, it was after Joseph died. Joseph wasn't, I don't know who the last of the tribes was, but when the last of the sons died, that's when the slavery
began. They came down with the beginning of the 7 years with the famine.
Yeah, right? 7 years, right.
Why didn't they leave after the famine was over?
That's a good question, too.
The famine?
I mean, we're talking about a long time later that we finally got enslaved. It was almost like we stayed there in a land we didn't belong in.
Right.
Asking for.
Right. That's a good question. I don't really answer that question. I mean, Yosef was the prime minister of the land at the time. He brought down his family. He gave them a nice land to live in. The famine may have still continued on in the land of Canaan. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I don't really answer that question.
So were the Jews happy there when they were slaves?
Initially, they were. Initially, they were happy there. They were comfortable.
So they didn't want to leave. They were happy.
Yeah, they were comfortable.
Go somewhere else if they were happy.
They were in Goshen. You know, the truth is that some commentators do blame them for becoming too comfortable there. At the very end of Parshas Vayigash, which is when the Jews came down to Egypt, it ends that the Jews settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, Vayachazuba. They clung to it, and they reproduced there. So the clinging to it, a lot of commentators say that is a negative take on what the Jews did. They shouldn't have clung to the land of Egypt. No, they could have lived there. They had to be there. There was a famine. You know, their uncle was in charge of the land, so we can be there for now. But the fact that they became a little bit too comfortable there, they are blamed for that. Many commentators, you know, do point out that was an inappropriate attitude towards the land.
And Goshen is part of Egypt?
Yeah, Goshen was a suburb they chose to live in. It's part of Egypt.
So it was close to leaving.
What did they do for Shabbat? Were they still working?
Once they were a slave, they had to work on Shabbat. It happened towards the end of slavery. Moshe was able to convince Pharaoh to give them Shabbat off towards the very end. But until that point, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And I want to get into that right now. I want to get into the slavery itself.
We haven't gotten commandments yet. We haven't been to Mount Sinai yet.
But there were traditions. Yeah, there were traditions from the others. From Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, they had traditions. They weren't obligated. But
never
they
figured
the
that out either.
Yeah. Well, there was a whole tribe that didn't. I guess the women were enslaved, which I didn't know.
The tribe of Levi was not enslaved.
The whole tribe was not enslaved.
Right.
Either.
The tribe of Levi never became slaves. They were committed to studying the Torah. Again, there was no Torah given yet, but they had traditions that they were studying and they were maintaining in their time in Egypt, and they were never enslaved by the Egyptians, the tribe of Levi. What I want to do now, which we have little time to do, is that I want to just go through some descriptions of the slavery itself. I mean, there's a lot of different scattered midrashim throughout rabbinic writings describing the slavery, you know, based on psukim in the Torah itself, based on the verses, things we may have heard before, may not have heard before, but it's so important just to get our minds into what it was like to be slaves. It's our heritage, it's where we came from, and it's from that we became a people. That God saved us from that terrible suffering and brought us out. It should make us feel that gratitude towards God for what He did for us, and also a part of our obligation at the Seder is to feel an emotional attachment to it. So when we discuss, I mean, some of these things are heart-wrenching, they're gruesome, but they're things which we have to understand and feel in order to appreciate the freedom. So I just want to read through you some descriptions given of the slavery itself. Let's just, in quick, the slavery began very gradually. It wasn't one day, okay, now you're all slaves. It wouldn't have worked. I mean, we were a growing people, we were very strong. Not all the Egyptians would have bought into it initially. It had to be a very gradual slide into slavery. So the rabbis tell us, initially, Pharaoh approached us very cordially. And he said, tomorrow we're going to have a community building day. We're all going to go out together and we're going to build. You know, join us. I'm going to be there too. They go out there and the Pharaoh's out there himself holding some bricks ready to build. Everyone come and join us. So the Jews said, okay, you know, we want to be good citizens. We're going to go out and help. So the Jews came out and they helped that day. They're still healthy and strong. So they worked very, very hard. At the end of the day, Pharaoh said, okay, now I know what you can do. That's going to be your quota daily for bricks. And then initially, and that was when they were still strong, they weren't slaves yet, so they had the ability to work very hard. So they set brick quotas for them. Initially, they were giving a lot of the building supplies. Okay, here's your supplies. You can build some for yourself as well. You'll build yourself houses with us houses. Here's all the supplies you need. And they would start making the bricks and building the houses. Eventually, Pharaoh started holding back some supplies. Go find your own supplies. But the quota stays the same. Eventually, it gets to the point where they're given zero supplies, but they're still expected to make the same quota of bricks every single day. But it was a gradual process into slavery. The taskmasters were appointed, and eventually, within about 80 or 90 years, they became totally subject to the Egyptians. So that's how it started. The slavery itself, just to discuss some things which happened. So the slavery began very early in the morning, very late at night. It was unbearable. I mean, the brick quota made, the rabbi says, was 400 bricks a day per person. Very difficult, hard labor. You know, working with bricks and cement, you know, in their days especially, it was extremely difficult labor. They had to get on top of all the I don't know how they did it, but the straw and mud, they had to trample with their feet, you know, kind of like the people in the wine, you know, trampling the grapes in a wine press. And day in and day out, the sticky, disgusting, dirty, you know, mud and cement needed to make bricks and to build. They had to produce the same quota daily, even though they were tired, even though they were sick. Summer, winter, spring, fall, cold, the hot, man, woman, and child was expected to produce their quota. They began very early in the morning, ended very late at night. Eventually, like we said, they weren't given supplies. To make it worse, Pharaoh decreed that the men should sleep in the fields at a certain point. Number one, because you could work more if you sleep in the field, because you don't have to go home and come out from your house. And number two, to disrupt family life, because they were trying to break our spirits just as much as our bodies. So they didn't want to have any healthy family life, you know, so the men were all away in the fields, the women and children just stayed at home. Because he was trying to break our spirits as well. It wasn't enough. They had the men work hard in the bricks, the women also had to work, as we said. And to make it even worse, the Egyptians sometimes would toss thorns into the cement, so we trampled with our feet, the thorns go into our feet. People would, and it didn't bother the Egyptians that the bricks came out bloody sometimes, as disgusting as it sounds. You know, but when we talk about the plagues, so there's something called Mida Kenegamida. The God does everything, you know, tit for a tat. Everything is measured and balanced. The plague of blood itself corresponds to all the blood which we had to bleed during our years of slavery. The fact that there was blood, bricks stained with our blood. The fact that we had to, that we were whipped, that we're going to see that we were subject to bites from wild animals, things like that. All that blood. So God said, for all that blood you caused Jews to bleed, I'm giving you the plague of blood. And every single plague connects with a lot of what happened during the slavery. But the blood is one that's very easy to see the connection. Discussing the women. So even when women were pregnant, they were forced to work. And one of the most heart-wrenching things, the rabbis tell us, even when they were in the middle of labor, they had to be there working in the cement. The Egyptians would not let them off. And sometimes they had to give birth when they were crushing cement, or else they would have been killed. And we don't want to think about what happened to those babies as if they were born into the cement. A very terrible thing. And after all of that, sometimes the Egyptians would kill the child after the fact, or the child might be trampled or stuck in the cement after the lady gave birth. And our screams and our tears fell on deaf ears. And they didn't care. That's part of the tragedy of the slavery.
Question?
Yes.
I remember hearing a midrash somewhere that the women actually were staying home and they were trying to make themselves look pretty, beautiful, so when the men came home from the fields, they would still want to have a marital life. Do you remember some midrash to that?
There's something like that, but yeah. Not that they would stay home all day, but they would still... The men slept in the fields, okay. Right? The women slept at home, as we said. So the women are given credit for even after going through this terrible day, as we described, they would still go home, they'd clean themselves up, dress up nice, and go out to their husbands in the fields, so they could continue some sort of marital life. The women are given credit for that. One of the reasons we were redeemed was because of the righteous women amongst the Jewish people. That's what the rabbis tell us. It was, a lot of our merit was because of the women. We discussed last week how they would give birth sometimes under these apple trees. We discussed the miracle of the children under the apple trees last week. So there were times we were able to give birth, you know, in a semi-normal environment. But if it was during the middle of the workday, the Egyptians would not let them off to give birth. If they're in labor, it would not make a difference. Another terrible part of this tragedy was that the Gemara tells us that at times, if they did not make their brick quota, so the Egyptians would take a child instead and stick the child in the wall and cement in the child rather than the bricks. That's part of the tragedy as well. At times, they would force the parents to cement the child into the wall, or at the risk of the parents' life. Again, you hear some of these things, and it does bring back some images you hear of the Holocaust sometimes.
Yeah.
And that cruelty carries on generation to generation, unfortunately. Now, a fun, fascinating comment on the idea of these children who were killed. The rabbis tell us that part of the process of Egypt, in a more spiritual sense, was to cleanse the Jews of evil. And those children that were killed were children who had some evil to them. We don't understand what that means exactly. It's more Kabbalistic concept. But the children that were killed, we were trying to eliminate the evil souls from the Jewish people. And one soul, the rabbis tell us.
I'm sorry, Rabbi, who was was? The Egyptians were trying to take out?
No, so part of the spiritual intent of these children being killed, from God's perspective, was to weed out the evil souls amongst the Jews. And those children were killed before they could enter into the world and reproduce. We don't understand how it works. The Egyptians didn't know this, and the Egyptians were doing it out of their own cruelty. But when you look at the heavenly perspective on the event, the rabbis tell us that Moshe davened that one of these babies should be saved. And the baby that was saved, his name is Micha. And Micha is somebody who became an idolater. He actually carried idols across the splitting of the sea, even from Egypt and outwards, even after experiencing the miracles. And there's a long story about him in the book of Judges, in the book of Shoftim, about his idols and what he caused amongst Jewish people. So that was one of these evil souls which was saved. So from our perspective, understand, what's the divine justice in this? So God has a plan. And God was trying to weed out certain elements for the Jewish people in this way. The Egyptians, though, it's not a way that we can defend the Egyptians, because the Egyptians did it out of pure cruelty, with evil intent, and not in order to help us in any way. But there is a divine perspective on it to understand divine providence involved in these deaths. The children themselves had to work. If you can imagine the children standing there, you know, crushing the cement, you know, bleeding feet. They were not given any rest. They were not given any ability to take a vacation, not to act as children. They had to work as soon as they could. And at times, even after their hard work, they would be the ones who are stuffed into the wall if the Jews did not meet their quotas. So you can picture the children in Egypt. And it was miraculous that any of us survived this terrible slavery. As I said, the work itself many times did not lead to accomplishments. The work itself was useless work. Things did not need to be done. Even when there was nothing left to do, the Egyptians would have us go and just say, go dig a hole under that tree for me. Not that they needed a hole, just to keep us working. They would say, you know, go heat some water up for me. They didn't even have water. They just wanted us to stay working. Because they were trying to break us down and pulverize us into nothingness. That's the bitterness of the slavery. It was day and night.
Is that called the farech in Hebrew?
Farech. There's the maror, the marirus. They made our lives bitter, and the farech is the backbreaking labor. This book I'm looking at is called Matame HaShulchan, and he does a great job of just kind of bringing home the concept, making you feel them. So at times he'll kind of go off into a story just to give you an image of a human being living through the slavery. So I'm going to read to you here the description. Again, based on what the rabbis teach us in the Midrash, but not, you know, he's paraphrasing in his own way to try to drive it home. But let's just paint for ourselves a picture. A Jew wakes up early in the morning, you know, before sunlight, and is forced out to go to work. They can hardly grab anything to eat. They don't have any food to eat. They grab a morsel for breakfast, whatever they have, and they're rushed out to the fields to work and making these bricks, making the cement, and they begin their quota of bricks for the day. Without any breaks, no coffee breaks, no rest. And they have to work at a murderous rate until night. So at night, let's be positive and assume they finish their brick quota. So you know, he says, okay, you can go home now. No child is killed that day because they hit their brick quota. As he goes home exhausted, you know, his bones are aching, back to his house. And then as soon as he sits down, maybe to eat a little bit of dinner, he's starving, he's bleeding, he's in pain, there's a knock at the door. And an Egyptian is there. And the Egyptian says, please come join me tonight at my party. Not as a guest, obviously, but I need a slave at my party. What do I need you to do? It's very dark. There's no electric lighting back there. I need you to hold a candle. But I want you to hold it on your head for me. That's what they would do. Put the candle on your head and don't move. So he's forced to stand there at this party at night. He's exhausted from a full day of labor. He has to stand there at this party at night. Now picture the person. He's looking around. All of his oppressors are there enjoying themselves. He smells the food. He sees the food, he's starving, he's tired, and he has to stand there and stand still with his candle on his head. Finally, late at night, the party's over, he can go home, they don't give him any food, he goes home, he gets some rest, and early next morning, doesn't matter when he went to bed, he's out there in the fields again, making the bricks. That was what a day would look like during the slavery. And for many years, you know, the decades and decades this went on, no break, no vacations. Eventually, Moshe was able to convince power to give them one day a week off for Shabbos. But besides that, they had no breaks. At the end of slavery, Pharaoh once again made them work on Shabbos at the very, very end. When Moshe was trying to get them freed, he says, okay, I see what you're doing. They got to keep on working. You know, but until that point, there was a time Moshe got them to have Shabbos off. Besides that, that was a day in the life of a slave in Egypt. Sometimes they are forced to go out and just sweep the streets from dust, which is impossible to do because streets just get dusty once again. They had to go out. A lot of times the Egyptians would send them out with their animals to pasture for months at a time. So you'd have one lone slave there with flocks and flocks of sheep in the middle of nowhere with his family back home. And he'd be on his own for months at a time without any food, just amongst the sheep. At times they would tell them, go bring us back some reptiles or some snakes or some scorpions so we can play with. Go out and catch scorpions for us. You go out to this nice Jewish slave is forced to go out and capture scorpions, which is a very dangerous thing to do. Venomous snakes at times. One of the worst things was, the rabbis tell us, that we were forced, sometimes they would say, go catch us a bear or a lion, a wild animal, a dangerous wild animal. And they sent out a band of slaves to catch wild animals for them. So they had no weapons, they had their bare hands, and they're forced, bring these back to us, or we'll kill your family, or they threaten them in terrible ways. So we can imagine many of them didn't make it back alive after these adventures. Some would come back, with maims, missing a limb because they were attacked by wild animals. So we hear in our mind the plague of wild animals. God sent the Aro, plague of wild animals, as a retribution for this. Because again, every plague is going to line up with some of the suffering of the slaves. But that was part of it. And you can imagine the families back home, wondering, will our father return back alive or not? Will we ever see him again? Will he come back with all of his limbs? And that's what happened. We can go on for a long time with this, but we see the slavery itself, and I hate to bring out such graphic images, but the slavery itself was something which was so terrible, so tragic. Again, a lot of it was purposeless. It was just in order to break our spirits, break us down. And the next part we're going to see, which I guess we're not going to have time for this year, but maybe next year, God willing, we'll move on to the Haggadah, and we'll discuss how the people eventually cried out to God. They davened. And just to read the next line of the Haggadah, we're a little bit late, just to put a little closure on this little happy ending. So it says that we cried out to the Lord, our God, of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice, saw our suffering, our labor, and our oppression. So we cried out to the God of our fathers, because the merit the Jews had in Egypt was the merit of the patriarchs and matriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. That was our merit. Our ticket into acceptance of our prayer was the fact that we were part of a long line of tradition, a great legacy left to us by our patriarchs and matriarchs. When there's nothing going for us, spiritually and physically, we were crushed. Emotionally, we were crushed. But we understood we were part of a heritage. We understood that there was a guarantee made to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that they'd be the parents of a great nation. And that's how we approach God, as the God of our fathers. If we notice in our weekly Shemoneh Esrei prayer, or in our daily Shemoneh Esrei prayer, both on Shabbos and during the week, the opening line is God and God of our fathers. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Because our true ticket into having our prayers heard, and our greatest merit as Jews, is the fact they're part of this great history and this great legacy. We have our own personal merits, but the overarching merit over the entire Jewish people for all of history is the fact that we come from this great line of tradition. We come from great people who have a great mission in the world, and God hears our prayers based on that. So after all the suffering and all the tragedy, we cried out to God. Our greatest weapon is our prayer. The rabbis point out that Esav was given the sword, Yaakov was given the mouth. Because our greatest weapon is not our sword, our greatest weapon is our mouth, our prayers. That's Hakol Kol Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Jacob, the Torah says. Because our greatest weapon is our powerful voice. Our mouths are our prayers. Through our prayer, with sincerity, God hears us, God responds, God saw our suffering, God saw our labor, God saw our oppression. The time had come, and Haggadah now moves on into the redemption. The Jewish people. Yes.
If the Jews had prayed earlier, would they have not been enslaved for so long?
That's a great question. It's a harder question to answer. The answer is yes and no. On the one hand, there was an ordained time for the redemption. On the other hand, the rabbis tell us that God was able to kind of manipulate that time to come earlier. Abraham was promised that Abraham was told they'll be enslaved for 400 years. Really, they only were enslaved for 210 years. So the rabbis say, well, how'd that work out? So there's different types of math you can do. Where did the 400 start? It didn't really start when they became slaves. It started when they first left the land of Canaan, which was earlier. And there's different ways. So the Haggadah tells us that God was able to chishev es hakeitz. God was able to calculate the proper time to redeem us. So had our merits built up, had we gotten the message earlier and cried out earlier, it could be that it would have been another way to calculate this 400 years. So on the one hand, there was a preordained time for redemption. On the other hand, you know, God has his ways. You know, and if God, if we deserve it at that time, God will redeem us. It's the same thing with, you know, people talk about calculating the time when Mashiach will come. Which is something we're not, it's not recommended to try to do even. But the Gemara talks about calculating when Mashiach will come. And ultimately, the answer is, well, Mashiach will come when he comes. And God's business to figure out how it fits all the calculations of the Gemara. I think it's not our business to figure out how it fits into all the calculations. You know, when we do the right thing, God will save us. And all of the preordained times, all the prophecies, they'll fit in. How will fit in? So they'll fit in. But it'll be fit in a way which we understand. Just like the 400 years of Egypt. It was only 210 years, but we calculate it as 400 in different ways. So any calculation like that is really based on our merit, based on our situation. And any prophecy given will fit what happens. So that's for sure. So if they cried earlier, I don't know what happened. That could be yes, could be no. But everything would fit in some way. Any other questions before we break for Pesach?
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Yes, we say Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
What?
We say Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Peace out.